Hello, and welcome to a new edition of Science on the Spot. On today's program, we will be talking about citizen science, a rather new scientific practice that is progressively gaining more adherence and is revolutionizing our way to see scientific development. In order to talk and discuss about this topic, we have invited to our STS radio studio a remarkable group of researchers whose projects deal very closely with citizen science. We will be taking a look at citizen science projects run by hunter-gatherers communities of Central Africa. These projects are helping them to manage deforestation and poaching problems. We will also talk about how citizen science could help us to improve accessibility for the mobility impaired across European cities like London. But first, we will see how versatile citizen science could actually be in urban context. A great variety of city problems could be solved by empowered individuals and communities using science. The social enterprise, Mapping for Change, aims to give these communities a voice, helping them to develop geographical solutions to tackle their problems through specific kinds of maps. We have with us the researcher and CEO of Mapping for Change, Louis Francis. Thank you for coming, Louis. I would like to start with some framing questions. So, how do you understand citizen science?
For me, citizen science is a way in which we can work with non-professional scientists across scientific research, ranging in activities from data collection, but also in terms of framing some of the research questions that are brought about in specific pieces of research. And it's also a way of involving lay people in research and helping us as a collective community get a better understanding of environmental social phenomena.
So in a way, it's a complementary part of professional science.
Exactly. It's not going to replace professional science, but it's about working as a collective, which enables us to be able to reach geographically things that as individual scientists, we don't have the capacity to do that on our own.
So what is the role of the professional scientist in citizen science projects?
I think the role of professional scientists within citizen science projects remains very similar to what the role of professional scientists has always been. But I think also what's happening more and more is professional scientists are having to rethink about the way in which they communicate, but also the way in which they can work collectively and collaborate with non-professionals.
Would you say that citizen science is limited to certain kind of problems?
I think the roots of citizen science lay more in the environmental domain. But I think what's happening more and more is that particular academic disciplines are looking at the ways in which citizen science can be embedded or incorporated into their own research practices. So I think in terms of what we'll be seeing going forward is a much broader diversity in terms of the various different realms in which citizen science is actually taking place within research.
So now I would like to talk more about Mapping for Change. Could you tell us what is this enterprise and what is your role in it?
Mapping for Change was established back in 2009 and it kind of span out from research that had been previously undertaken within the university. And what we found is that there was an appetite for the type of work that we were doing. And that's really about working with communities to use maps as a tool for communication. So it's about really trying to understand what's happening in a particular location, whether that be kind of looking at the social issues and social aspects of a particular place. It could be environmental, it could be anything. And it's about enabling communities to actually have their say.
Well, it sounds like a very versatile enterprise and you could tackle different kind of problems. Could you give us some examples?
I mean, a lot of what we've done more recently is working with communities to collect data in relation to air pollution, which is a serious problem within urban cities. And what we've done is design methodologies which are easily learnt so that communities can collect data about specific pollutants such as nitrogen dioxide. And then we're able to create maps from that data and really get a better understanding in terms of the temporal variability. And even just in getting communities involved in that process means that they're learning about some of the health impacts that air quality has on them. They can make choices about the routes that they take, for example, taking the children to school or commuting, so that they're aware that certain routes within their neighbourhood are much more polluted than others.
But beyond making choices, do the citizens and the community at large have the chance to actually propose practical solutions and thus becoming change agents themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we found, we worked with one community in Putney, and they used that the data that they collected during their monitoring program to sit down with the MEP, to sit down with the local authority and Transport for London. And what they were able to do in that particular instance is push Transport for London to introduce retrofit buses along one of the most polluted routes in London much earlier than they would have done without this kind of impetus that was generated from their activities.
That is actually relevant. And it makes me think about how these projects came about. I mean, are these projects demanded by the people? Are they solicited by the local authorities? Or are they just suggested by you, the people in Mapping for Change, to specific communities?
I mean, I think now we've probably worked with over 25 different communities, just specifically looking at air quality, and the involvement varies. I mean, in some cases, we've been asked by the local authority to do a particular kind of engagement around air quality. In other cases, we've had communities come up to us and say, we've got a problem. We want to, you know, we really think our area is polluted. We're concerned about our children walking along the main roads to schools. And we'd really like you to help us with the methodology and the technique and how we can go about not only collecting the data, but using this information then to engage the relevant stakeholders into the whole kind of wider discourse. And I think that people living in a particular area, if they've got a concern about something, they want to ensure that the data they collect can stand the test of time. So they are quite diligent about the way in which they go about collecting the data.
Are these projects mainly based in London?
In terms of air quality, most of the projects that we have are in London. But, I mean, in terms of some of the other citizen science projects, it's not just London-based. We're working in Poland, and we've got a number of communities, and we're always open and willing to share. Right. So it's not necessarily that we have to actually be directly involved, but it is about sharing that knowledge to enable others to actually carry out and do similar actions and activities in their particular locations.
So it seems like we will be able to see every time more and more citizen science projects all over the world. But beside this geographical expansion, how do you see the future of citizen science and what would be the role of Mapping for Change in that future?
I mean, I always see Mapping for Change as taking on a role of facilitation. And it's not so much about us setting the agenda. It's about how can we facilitate and enable communities to participate and get involved in citizen science projects. But also from the research perspective, how can we also facilitate and bridge that gap between the kind of academic side and also the kind of layperson's involvement. So I see that we will continue to do that over time.
Thank you, Luis. If you have more interest about what is Mapping for Change, what are the projects or the researchers, you could check their website at www.mappingforchange.org.uk. Now we're moving to a particular project in Mapping for Change called myaccessible.eu, a project that will produce insights about how using online maps could enhance accessibility for people with different kinds of disabilities. We have with us the researcher and manager of this project, Rebecca Payne. Welcome, Rebecca. First of all, could you tell us in more depth what are the aims of this project and what is your role in it?
The aims of myaccessible.eu are really to just try and understand the main accessibility issues that people with limited mobility experience in EU cities. So things like using public transport or accessing housing or going to the shops, just understanding really what the landscape is like for them in terms of getting out and about. And then from this understanding of the issues, moving forward to develop particular mobile applications and online tools to try and overcome some of those barriers that people experience. And my role really so far has been to help engage the communities and actually find out what the issues are like for them on a day-to-day basis in order to inform the development of the tools.
So how do you engage the people in these projects?
Through a number of different channels, I suppose. We like to try and engage people around the issues specifically. So we've gone to a lot of different events and forums where issues around the topic of accessibility have been discussed. We've also done a lot of kind of online engagement through social media and things like that, trying to get people to come forward with their experiences. And we've also held a number of workshops with wheelchair users or other groups with limited mobility where they can kind of voice their concerns that they're having and set the topics for discussion.
But in that sense, are the participants and volunteers of these projects just limited to disabled people?
Well, the project, in theory, is kind of applicable to people just with limited mobility in general. So obviously that could encompass parents with pushchairs or elderly people that maybe take a bit longer to get out and about, as well as wheelchair users, of course. So it's quite broad in its scope.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the user interface that are you using for collecting the data?
Well, at the moment, the project tools are kind of being developed at this stage, so they're not really in use. But they're being informed through quite rigorous user testing, obviously, to check that they're intuitive and helpful for people. But one of the project partners, a social enterprise called Sozialhelden, who are based in Berlin, they have an online crowdsourced map for accessibility called WheelMap, which basically allows people to input information about the accessibility of different buildings or venues. And that kind of thing has been informing the sort of work that we do. So this idea of people crowdsourcing accessibility information has been very important, obviously, to the project.
And how this project is different from WheelMap, for example?
Well, the tools being developed are slightly different to WheelMap in that WheelMap is just a map which kind of displays accessible destinations. But the tools we're developing as part of this project will be more to do with routing and navigation. So we're trying to acquire data about the built environment in order to plot routes for people with limited mobility.
As in any project, maybe you come across with some technical problems. Could you tell us some of the main problems that you have dealt with?
Sure. Well, for me, the main problem has been trying to kind of understanding the needs of the developers in the project and communicating them to people that we require the data from. So we've done a lot of work trying to get data sets from, say, local authorities around London and having quite technical, complicated discussions with them about the types of data that is available, the licensing agreements, and what we would be doing with the data exactly. And that's been quite challenging for me personally.
So once that you have solved the licensing issues and get access to this data, and also the community volunteers collect new data as well, the public comes with more and better information to plan their travels. But what are the next steps in order to actually improve accessibility in the city, both in terms of infrastructure or signage?
Sure, yeah, and I suppose that's more where the work of Mapping for Change comes in, which is more about actually raising awareness about what the issues are. So in my mind, the project has two kind of separate domains. One is this technical development of tools, but then one is the more on the ground, these are the issues, what can we do to change them in the built environment now?
How these preliminary results in London are different from what have you been doing in other cities?
It's been interesting. Every city has obviously slightly different issues in terms of what communities have raised as important, but there have been certain themes that have come up again and again in every pilot city, and transport has definitely been one of those, both in terms of kind of the physical accessibility of different vehicles, but also really broader problems with the attitudes or lack of awareness of staff.
To finish, I would like to ask you, what are the main lessons that you have learned about citizen science by doing this project?
Oh, good question. I would say citizen science is just a really fantastic kind of tool, and it's a really important idea going forward into the future. And for me, as I've said, I wasn't really aware of the role so much that technology could play and how important things like that could be for people. But I think it's opened my eyes to, you know, all of these different types of ways that technology can be used in promoting citizen science types of agendas. So, for example, maybe when I'd heard the term citizen science before doing this project, I thought it was exclusively to do with environmental issues, you know, pollutants and things like that. It never occurred to me that it could be used to change the face of the built environment and communicate right. people's problems in the built environment. So I would say it's really opened my eyes to the kind of myriad of ways that it can be used.
Well, those are really inspiring words. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you very much. To the audience, if you would like to get more information about this project, you could check their website at myaccessible.eu, or you could go to Mapping for Change website and look for the section. Well, finally, we will talk about citizen science projects that go beyond the city context and work with people that may be not that familiar with technology or science for that matter. We have with us Dr. Jerome Lewis, anthropologist and co-director of the Extreme Citizen Science Research Group from UCL. Thank you for being here, Jerome.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I would like to ask you, what is extreme about this group?
Well, citizen science has tended mostly to be practiced by men living in urban centres in Europe. And one of the objectives of the Extreme Citizen Science Group is to bring the possibilities and benefits of citizen science to a much broader audience. And so the word extreme in this case refers to non-literate people who live in remote rural areas who maybe have never even seen a smartphone, but would still benefit from the possibilities that a citizen science project could afford them. And also extreme environments. So we work with walrus hunters in the Arctic. We work with hunter-gatherer communities in remote forest areas of Central Africa. We work with indigenous tribes living on their own territories in the Amazon. And so these represent some of the more extreme environments.
I would like to focus on a particular project that you're working on with communities in Central Africa. Could you tell us more about those projects?
Well, it's a range of projects. The first project we did some time ago was linked to a new set of legal requirements that the European Union was imposing on nations who export timber. Having worked for 20 years with communities living in the forests where this timber is sourced, I knew that there were some quite serious problems that they faced, namely the prime commercial species is also a very important source of caterpillars, which are very valued because they are delicious. So it's a resource which is not just very important for communities' nutrition, but it's also a very important source of revenue for the most marginalized members of the most marginalized communities in these countries. So the idea in this case was to create a system whereby a logging company that wished to be socially responsible in its activities could avoid taking out or cutting down trees on which communities depended on. And so we developed the first set of tools for doing this.
You were referring to some legal problems with logging companies, but what about illegal activity in the area?
Well, spotting illegal activity is extremely difficult because of the remoteness and the low population densities of these regions. And so local people are very often aware of what's going on in their local area. So one of the projects we have tries to tap into that knowledge by allowing them to map those illegal activities. And then, of course, what to do about illegal activities? Well, you need to develop very clear networks of relationships between the people collecting the data, the people responsible for addressing those illegal activities, and monitor those relationships to check that they aren't being perverted by various other forces like corruption.
So it could be actually risky for some of the volunteers to collect the data.
It can be very risky. One of our projects, the anti-poaching project, for instance, so this was local hunter-gatherers being very fed up by the amount of commercial poaching going on in their traditional areas, which has all sorts of risks for them. So lots of traps laid in forest areas means that it's dangerous for children when they're walking through. But it also destroys the fauna. And as these people live from the wild animals, that means that their livelihoods are at stake. So they asked us to create software to help them record all the observations they make of these illegal activities. The time it's taken us to develop with them the software, it's taken over a year and a half. And in that time, the situation has deteriorated so much that the people who originally asked for the software to be made are frightened to use it because they don't feel that they have adequate protection from reprisals. So we're now currently renegotiating relationships with the enforcement agencies, and there have been certain changes in terms of corrupt individuals.
It's a very complex situation, yeah. I would like to understand more about the devices that you're using, how the people are reacting to these technological devices.
Well, people are mostly naive. They've never met these or encountered or used, say, smartphones, which is what we use. So we have a relatively cheap smartphone that's waterproof, robust, and we have created an app which allows you to compose sets of choices that we call a decision tree, which people can make according to what they've identified as the issues they want to investigate are. So we co-develop the images with the people. So we will start with by imagining an informed imagining of what they would need. We then present that to people in their villages and their camps. They feed back on whether they understand or not, whether we should improve this image or add something. We then test the software by walking around in the local area in the forest to see whether it matches with the things that they want to collect. And so we will continuously redevelop the software with the communities together until everybody across different language groups, but everybody who has expressed a desire to participate can understand and use the software.
In order to deal with technology, how do you train the people? And furthermore, do you train the community as a whole or only a selected group of volunteers?
Well, we try and work with the community so they decide who does that.
Okay.
In our experience so far, people know who knows the area best. And we've also found that when we work with the community in general, regardless of the level of education, what language people speak or whatever, there is often someone who just gets it really fast, these intuitive technological systems. And so what we try and do is responsibilize that person once we've identified them with the task of training other people.
What are the next steps for spreading these projects to other communities in Africa?
It's when we hear about requests, we try and support people to find solutions. But that what we really want to happen is a much more autonomous spreading so that these projects are then taken on by local people rather than always depending on us.
Yeah, like a more natural process.
Yeah, so that it just spreads in its own way.
To finish, I would like to ask you, what are the main lessons that you have learned by working with these communities in citizen science, and what are the impacts that it could have in people's lives?
It's a mixture of different lessons in different domains. One is the time it takes. You know, these things are long, ongoing processes, and you won't see results rapidly, but you will see change, and that's important, but it's incremental over time. So we have a number of PhD projects within the group who are looking very specifically at what are the lessons we're learning, how knowledges mix, you know, where you have people who understand the world in terms of For instance, an animate nature. So nature is not just an object out there for exploitation and manipulation, but it's something which lives, breathes, thinks, has consciousness. And those are very interesting crossovers where you're trying to represent the environment in a very objective way, which is what maps do, but also to hold a respect for these much more animate and subjective ways that communities understand the environment.
Of course. And I think we all have to learn about those lessons as well. So, to the people in the audience, if you're still interested in learning more about the Extreme Citizen Science Group, you could check their website at www.ucl.ac.uk/excites. And now, I would like to thank my interviewees for coming to our program, Science on the Spot, and invite all the audience to listen to our program next week, in which we will talk about open access to science. That will be all for today. This is Hernán Bobadilla. Take care and goodbye.